My God, that music sounds like we're going to have a real show. Sounds like we actually have to deliver on something. Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable. It is the 10th of April, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. A delight to have you with us this morning. We have a great group, a great panel, and a lot to talk about. So put all that together, and it seems like we will have a good show. Times Union columnist Chris Churchill is with us. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you here. Former New York State Senator, SUNY New Paltz Communications Professor. Terry Gibson, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. And Berkshire Eagle reporter Jen Smith is here.
Good morning.
Hello,
it's good,
Jen.
To be here.
WAMC's Alan Shartok. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Joe. We had a very exciting talk with the governor yesterday. He made a lot of news. Not if you read the Times Union, but if you read the Daily News or the New York Times or the Daily News or the New York Times or the New York Post, that he made a lot of news. The most important thing he said was that he would sign, and nobody had ever heard him say this before, the Dignity in Dying Bill, you know, Death in Dying, which I think is really an extraordinary and important bill. So, It's nice to make news, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we will hopefully talk about a lot of news this morning, and we will get right to it. We invite you to join us. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org. All right. After a tight race, Benjamin Netanyahu appears poised to form Israel's next government. It was kind of back and forth there for a while, but Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's conservative prime minister for the past decade, appeared poised to win a fourth consecutive term in office and a fifth overall, according to two preliminary results early on Wednesday. Both Mr. Netanyahu and his chief rival, Benny Gantz, a centrist former military chief, declared victory after Tuesday's parliamentary election, appearing to win the same number of seats in the Israeli parliament. But a count of the broader blocks needed to form a coalition government appeared to give Mr. Netanyahu a clear advantage over Mr. Gantz. Mr. Netanyahu now seems all but sure to surpass the nation's founding leader as Israel's longest-serving prime minister.
Ben-Gurion.
Yes, David Ben-Gurion. Victory will also provide the 69-year-old Benjamin Netanyahu with a renewed mandate as he battles a looming indictment on charges of bribery and corruption. Who would like to begin?
Well, I would like to begin by saying, I hate to say I told you so, but I told you so, I told you so. I told you yesterday it was going to happen. It was so clear, Jen and I were just talking about it, that all of the various small parties, the right-wing parties, spelled victory for Netanyahu. It's that simple. When they ask him to form a government, he'll be able to do it. Now he has lots of challenges, including the advance warning from the Attorney General that he intends to indict him. Mm-hmm. Apparently the electorate didn't care that much. And it was interesting that in some of the victory parties you saw Trump signs all over the place. So there is this nice arrangement. I say nice in sarcastic quotes. Between Netanyahu and Trump.
Well, there's a lot of similarities in his strategies, too. I mean, as the elections got closer, you saw Netanyahu lash out at the media more and, galvanize his own base, which included the right.
Donald Trump.
Yep. again, there's sort of a lot of similarities there. But I do wonder whether this will be also, because of the pending indictments, Netanyahu's shortest term.
Could be.
Well, I'm definitely intrigued just from the psychological point of view of what it is that allows voters to support someone who is about to be indicted on bribery charges. But it is very similar to the same voters that here in New York are likely to vote for Trump, regardless of all of his various corruption issues. I think there's a lot of similarities there, and I think it's very intriguing. I don't live in Israel, obviously, and I'm certainly not an expert on it. But I just think that relationship between Trump and Israel is very interesting. And I suspect that from Trump's point of view, it's all very selfish and self-serving with very little policy behind it. But the many in the Israeli population seem to be very favorable to Trump, and I just find that intriguing.
Well, one of the key things in the election, though, is that the evidence for those bribery charges was withheld from the voters, right? So it made it very difficult for them to assess how much weight to put on it, I suppose. And you know, when someone's been in office as long as Netanyahu has, I think people are more likely to give him the benefit of the doubt on those things.
And things aren't necessarily economically terrible for people there right now. And
on the contrary.
In terms of, you know, that, I think also if you look deeper into how cultural nuances play into voting decisions, right? A lot of the right and religious groups will, you know, look to the rabbis and sort of to advise them versus, you know, making a necessarily independent vote. And if you look at some of the issues that are going to be addressed in the new parliament, that affects those groups. For example, the law, you know, saying that ultra-Orthodox Jews will be excused from military service.
That's a big one.
It's a big one. Another thing that people who didn't show at the polls are the Arab population.
Well, they didn't show because they weren't allowed to show.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and that was part of Netanyahu's doing, which was the, you know, incitement of that group there, too. Yet at the same time, that group wasn't really clamoring to fight back to regain that. But again, we see that role of sort of this racism playing into the politics, just like we are seeing here in the U.S.
I'm no expert on Israeli elections and politics, but it didn't seem to me that Mr. Gantz was giving voters that much of an alternative. I mean, he was just his campaign seemed to be, I'm not Netanyahu. But there didn't seem to be a message. I mean, the policies seemed to align pretty closely. And maybe that's a lesson for Democrats heading into 2020. I mean, you can't just make it all about the opponent. And you do have to offer people kind of a positive message of your own.
Right. And I think Elizabeth Warren was saying that before. You can't just be the anti-Trump. And same thing in Israel. Yeah. You can't just be the anti-Netanyahu. I mean, yes, this guy had certainly plenty of experience and he was able to sort of mobilize his backing. You can't blink at the numbers. And obviously they've split with the number of seats that their parties gained. But at the same time, he didn't take that extra step to say, like, you know, what Netanyahu did with the Arabs was wrong. You know,
right.
I
don't think he criticized many of the policies at all.
And his policy on, you know, what's happening with the Palestinians also wasn't very apparent.
I think also a lot of this could have to do with not so much personal about Netanyahu, but just that a large majority of the Israeli population clearly feels that they want to keep the sort of conservative right policies in place, regardless of who the prime minister is, as long as they'll enforce those policies. So maybe they're thinking, yeah, something could come of these trials and he could find himself in a difficult position. But at least for the time being, we'll continue to have the power and we can worry about fighting and replacing, you know, Netanyahu with another a far right politician if the time comes. But until now, he's our guy.
Let's just try to remember what the Israeli citizen is thinking. One, This is not a pain for obviously for Netanyahu, who I am not a fan of whom I am not a fan. Mm-hmm. However, the economy, as you mentioned, Jen, is doing extremely well in Israel. The safety, there have been an occasional rocket here and there, but basically, there have never been a time of more perceived safety on the part of the average Israeli citizen than there ever was. And three, Trump keeps giving them presents of one kind or another. The argument, I think Chris is right, the argument about the middle is so interesting. This guy is a former military chief. And he obviously did this blue and white party. And the theory was, well, you can't beat him from the left, that's for sure, right now. But I'll be a more moderate guy, and maybe I'll be Netanyahu light or whatever. But they're saying as long as there's going to be Netanyahu light, why?
Mm-hmm.
What's the rationale?
And that shows obviously in the seats that were taken. I think that center block had, you know, 10 fewer seats than the kind of right movement there.
Sure. No, that's what it's all about. Because of this plethora of third parties and fourth parties and fifth parties, and the majority of those are to the right, and apparently the polling is showing that the sentiment in the country is moving substantially right. Mm-hmm. That's the way it is.
Can we talk for a moment if anyone wants to? And if you don't, that's fine. I'll move on. But just the idea that, I mean, Israel, the United States, even Britain, a lot of countries are moving right. What is it in the world character that is pushing us that way?
Well, I don't know. If you listen to Bernie Sanders, you don't think that the world is moving right. Mm. And Bernie Sanders is leading, right after Joe Biden, of course, who is not yet a declared candidate, leading, and he's the left
I mean, to use your thing, this is still what got Trump elected. It's what brought us to Brexit. It was what brought Netanyahu to power.
Well, do you think that's nationalism?
It's different in every. You could throw Brazil into that equation too. I mean, it's different in every country, but I think in a lot of countries, it's not necessarily Israel, but you know, immigration seems to be a driving force for the rightward frustration. With immigration, seems to be a driving force for the rightward movement in some countries. Certainly, seems to be the case with Brexit and to a degree with Trump too.
And it's not even just immigration. I think it's that sense of the other. You know, there's like a majority versus
the
other.
And also just a frustration with elites, a frustration with, you know, the consensus that has governed the world for the last 20, 30 years.
Sure.
Well, there's also a lot of economic and environmental issues that are driving migration in ways that we haven't seen in the past, that is putting a lot of pressure on a lot of borders around the world, including ours. And it is giving people who may be more of an extremist on the immigration issue an opportunity to really speak up and point to the border and say, see, I told you. We got to do something.
You know, but it was said, I think Joe said it, that here's Trump, and he is identified by many of us as from the right. But when he ran for public office, it wasn't only that he had some right-wing things. He talked about bringing the drug companies under control. He talked about, you know, so many of these populist issues that had nothing to do with really being right-wing.
And I think some of that, I mean, a lot of this is more populism than it is necessarily a rightward. I mean, I think that's true with Sanders, too. I mean, there's this he kind of expresses a frustration with the system. You know, the system is rigged. He and Trump both say that pretty often. Well, and I think a lot of people believe it for good reason.
Isn't everyone saying that? Who's not saying that?
Well, they have a lot in common.
It's harder for some. If you're Joe Biden, it's much harder to make that point. You've been in power for 30 years.
If you're part of the rigged system, it's harder to say.
Joe's not officially in the race either. Everyone in the race is saying the system is rigged.
But he keeps getting quoted as saying, you know, those of us who grew up in Pennsylvania in the middle class are not being handled fairly, which is interesting because that's his own version of populism. And if you take a look at the polling on who, you know, AOC and everything else, the majority of people who won in Congress are not to the left. They're middle right, middle conservative.
I think, I mean, you know, Trump is kind of all over the place ideologically, but he is not, at least he didn't run this way, and he has governed this way. I don't know. You could argue, but
could argue that he's governing. I would argue.
I'm just saying. He did not run as he is not a right. There's been this kind of libertarian consensus in economics for the last 20 years, Democrats and Republicans alike. You know, free trade, and he ran to the left of that. You know, whether he's governed that way, we could argue, but he did at least run. Talking about getting rid of NAFTA and free trade and all these things, and there are echoes of what you hear from Sanders in Trump's 2016 message. Again, whether he's governed that way is open for debate.
Well, Sanders and Trump do have one thing in common, and that's their taxes.
Yes.
Yes.
Issues or the lack of transparency thereof.
Well, I think we're going to see Bernie Sanders' taxes though any day now, and I don't think we're going to see Donald Trump's taxes.
Bernie pulled a dumb move. To be honest with you, there was no good reason. He said, look, if you want to, here's the left-wing socialist Democrat saying, look, okay, I'm a millionaire, but I got to be a millionaire by writing a book. which is simple. If you want to be a millionaire, you should write a book also. It's quite simple.
I wonder if he even wrote that book. Does he have a ghostwriter in that thing? I mean, a lot of politicians do, but that's kind of irrellevant. But he makes it.
I mean, I would only assume
so.
Was that the way anybody could write a book?
Well, but he also had a chance during his last, bid for office to have that prepared. You know, that's coming. That's something that is historically.
No, he should have released. He should.
Well, the funny joke is that Sanders doesn't want to release his taxes because he's too rich, and Trump doesn't want to release his taxes because he's too poor. Mm-hmm. You know, they're both embarrassed about their incomes.
Absolutely.
In different ways.
If it doesn't come fluidly, there's something to raise.
But
an
it was a
to.
Dumb move on Bernie's
But it's
part,
also Trump doesn't want to release his taxes because he's going to be embarrassed about why he is so poor, like all the various corrupt things that he's done to get poor. I think Bernie Sanders is going to, I hope he's going to show that he's been legitimately made rich. Although, let's put it into perspective, becoming a millionaire these days is not what it used to be, right? $1 million is nowhere near what it used to be. So,
fair enough.
I'd be happy to be a millionaire if I could, but I think we probably need to start coming up with a new number to talk about wealth.
Billions.
Yeah, billionaire is more realistic these days.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to talk about. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue, and we have Alan Chartok, Jen Smith. Terry Gibson is here. We have Chris Churchill, and we welcome your input, roundtable@wamc.org. Well, we gather some more letters. Let's move on to some other topics, and we will go to the border crisis. The headline in the Washington Post today is 12 Days of Chaos Inside the Trump White House's Growing Panic to Contain the Border Crisis. And as I was reading that, I heard our own Sarah Rogerson saying, it's not a crisis. Okay. He had threatened to close the southern border and ordered a halt to foreign aid for three Central American nations. But as President Trump weighed his next move to respond to mounting immigration crisis, he had another problem. His Homeland Security chief was in Europe on a week-long business trip. The location of Kirstjen Nielsen, the embattled leader of the Department of Homeland Security on April 1st, was like a bad joke for a president who vowed to curb unauthorized immigration but was now showing signs of panic as border crossings spiked to the highest levels in more than a decade. Except no one was laughing. Trump was livid. Nielsen was in London, then headed for Stockholm and Paris to huddle with U.S. allies on counterterrorism and cybersecurity issues. Although Nielsen aides had informed the White House of the trip, Trump complained to her on the phone that she was out of town while the border was, in his words, out of control, according to officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss a private conversation. Nielsen, who had barely hung on to her job during previous run-ins with Trump, cut her trip short, flew back to Washington. Upon returning, she furiously tried to save her job. She convened emergency calls with White House aides and cabinet officials to urge them to help her on immigration. White House officials said that she ordered U.S. Customs and Border officials to deploy emergency surge operations, shifting up to 750 officers from other duties to help the overwhelmed Border Patrol, and then she was fired.
Sounds familiar. Was that a TV show?
I was going to say, right. You're fired.
Right. You know, it's I've said this before. Clearly, Donald Trump had the campaign skills that he needed to get elected. But those campaign skills are not the kind of skills that are needed to run the United States of America, to lead the United States of America. He lacks any significant leadership skills that would allow him to solve really any significant problems. And this is a problem that is happening on his watch, and he is going to be held accountable for it by certainly the Democratic voters, but I think also, more importantly, the independent voters are watching this very closely. And he is really struggling to find someone who can do what he ought to be able to do, which is lead, and he hasn't found that person yet.
Yeah, I think I think there's some dangers in this border situation for Democrats, but I think if they want to run, if part of their 2020 message is about incompetence, I think that this is a perfect issue for them to kind of highlight. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the kind of the thing that he has made the centerpiece of his administration. And not only has the problem not been solved, it's actually gotten quite a bit worse.
Well, the crisis is internal, right? About how to manage this. We know the issues. We know what needs to be done. We can hear from people working on the border saying, this is the problem. This is the problem. You know, like, you know, we don't have enough staff in this place. We don't have enough, you know, there's the courts aren't processing this fast enough. You know, these are fixable things that no one seems to either have the jurisdiction or just the force to solve and say, like, then let's address them.
I mean, they are difficult problems. Obviously immigration's been a problem for a long time, mm-hmm. or illegal immigration, or the border, however you want to put it. Difficult problems require, like Terry said, leadership. They require, you know, thoughtfulness.
And thoughtful strategy. People
seems to
who
be,
know
he seems
how to,
have
do
exacerbated
that.
All the what's yeah.
And the you know also you know a good leader will reach out and hire good people, and then he will support them by delegating to them the power they need to do what he asked them to do. And this is a process that is just completely foreign to this guy. I mean, he just doesn't understand how leadership works.
You know, you were kidding around before when you talked about you're fired and the television program. But I do think that was his level of success. And he thinks that it will work here, too. He doesn't give a damn about any of the people who work for him. And I don't think he cares about policy that much. I mean, I'm sitting here thinking that a policy has to do with immigration and who can come over and who can't. I think it's basically yelling at the top of his lungs, look at them, look at them, look at them. And everybody says, yeah, look at them, look at them. But nobody really has an idea. I mean, who's picking the crops? Who's you can't walk by in my little town of Great Barrington, you can't walk by a door. And I think that's true in Albany, too, without, you know, we're hiring in supermarkets and everywhere else. So we were treated to a story this morning on NPR about the robotic industry is growing like crazy because we don't have enough jobs, enough people to go around for the jobs. I think policy as a concept is overblown. That's what I'm thinking.
Well, I think I'm not even sure Donald Trump knows how to spell policy, much less understands it. I mean, every report we get from his internal circle is that he's very frustrated at any effort to try to explain anything to him that relates to policy. He's really just interested in what can serve him for the moment, what can make him look good for the moment.
Right.
Anything that threatens his ego or threatens what he believes to be his perception as a winner is something that he immediately begins to shout at and scream at and throw things at, and people are just falling like dominoes around him.
So, Chris, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I also think it's not just a matter of policy, but also, I mean, the states have been, you know, confronting these issues for far longer and are far more expert in managing them because they know what the effects are in their towns. And I think it's listening and letting that also inform the decisions that you make. And I also think, you know, it's this challenge that's getting tired of saying that, Alan, you made the comment about, you know, who's picking the crops. Yes, we need people, and immigrants have historically taken those jobs, but we also have people who are coming from other countries with a lot of expertise who also can't get into the jobs that we need, who are doctors where they've come from, who are engineers, who, you know, and that's a problem too. There is, you know, potential solutions and positive impact that can be happened, that can happen if someone really steers this into a progressive and productive light.
I think the other thing that's happening too is that part of this whole frustration for the president is that he doesn't understand that all of these departments that fall under his responsibility as president are staffed with full-time career policy makers, people that have been there for 20, 30 years, that their job is to dive deep into policy and offer policy advice and help create policy. And they're not so anxious on a day-to-day basis to jump to every whim, every sort of command, every sort of knee-jerk reaction that this president has. They are used to doing things in a slow, steady, methodical way, and that doesn't fit well with his process. And in some ways, I think that's
points to the strength of our democracy and that it serves as a check on the president, any president, that they can't completely just override an entire department that has 1,000 employees in it who have been doing this for 20 years.
But isn't that also the problem within Congress, too, is that they're the same slow-moving pace, but yet they're power holders in making these decisions too, and they and then you throw in the fact that, you know, Trump is constantly, you know, berating Congress to make any decisions, and then you throw Nielsen in the middle, who's supposed to, I guess, just be a mediator instead of actually doing her job. I mean, it was a losing battle that she was fighting, and she wasn't really making any progress in doing her job either.
And then there's the courts. The courts continue to more often than not shoot down various radical ideas that he has and he tries to push through. So there are a lot of forces working against him on any given day, and I'm personally thankful for that.
Were you going to ask me something, Alan?
Yes, I was. I'm so glad you you reminded me. What you didn't remind me of, because you didn't know, is what I was going to ask you.
Right.
And I don't remember.
Oh, okay. So,
but it is fascinating to me, Chris, that that as a nation, as a group of people who have minds, you know, we attribute them shorthand to why are they there? What are they thinking? They're thinking about specific policy areas. See, I don't think that's the way it works. I think the character of the leadership becomes almost the entire deal. Now, yeah, if somebody's going to lose their health care for their kid who's 25 years old or 24 years old, they're going to know it at the time. But I don't think that that's what's driving this machine. However, I do believe that the fact that the Republicans are different from the sort of neo-populist Trump, where is the difference? I don't know. But I can tell you that the one thing that the Republicans believe in is the judiciary and loading that judiciary. And the rest of it, they don't care much about. And I think that's true with Trump also. So that's the intersection. What do you think about that, Chris?
I don't know what I think about that. I think I talked earlier a little bit about the dangers for Democrats in this, and I think that there are a lot of voters who are frustrated with immigration. I hear from them all the time, and
frustrated how?
They're frustrated that the border, the people keep coming across the border. They're frustrated with illegal immigration.
So they don't want them.
It's
what you're saying.
The nation's laws are being violated, and they're upset about it. You know, and I think the danger for Democrats is that if they don't, at least people see that Trump is frustrated about it, and I think a lot of voters identify with that.
But what is
if they feel that Democrats are thwarting him at every turn, I think they may end up going with Trump on that issue.
What is he frustrated about? Is he frustrated that he can't put a stop to the immigration?
Is he
frustrated with the fact that he's getting blamed for not being able to carry through as opposed to the specifics of immigration?
Well, I think it's a complicated problem. I mean, the problem that's happening right now is not illegal immigration. These people are not coming illegally. They're coming and legally applying for asylum, and then we don't know how to handle the vast numbers of people. It's a very different problem in a sense than the problem that he railing against, which was illegal immigration, people illegally crossing the border. And I don't think that he has been able to adjust his language and his mindset very well to recognize that it's a very different problem.
Well, and also his
that requires
sense.
Very different solutions.
Like,
a wall does nothing for asylum seekers. I mean, they just come and they seek asylum no matter what.
But he's threatening to cut aid and
exacerbates the problem.
Which in a country that was making, you know, for let's take Honduras for example, where they had actually been making progress, like they had decreased some of the crime rates there. You know, immigration levels have gone down, although it's still happening, of course. But at the same time, he also endorsed that president who was embattled with corruption and other scandals too. So I mean, it's sort of mixed messages there. Then, you know, you're part of the problem if you're endorsing the reason why people are leaving.
Well, and Trump sends mixed messages all the time. There have been times when he seemed very willing to compromise with Democrats in some sort of grand strategy to kind of address the problem. And then he gets pushback from the Ann Coulters of the world and he immediately flips. So it has made even though he talks a lot about this problem, no one really knows exactly where he stands on it. It's just tough talk without any sort of
plan. Yeah. Right, there's no plan. And that's what I was going to say, was that I think until he can come up with a very clear plan and make a very persuasive pitch that this is the plan that will solve all of our border immigration issues, I think it's going to be difficult for him to continue to blame the Democrats for the problem. If he comes up with a plan and he can convince the American people that this is a good plan, and I don't think the wall is that plan, then I think there is a danger for the Democrats to continue to pressure him on that. But he hasn't done that yet. And I think, again, that goes back to his lack of leadership skills, his lack of being willing to listen to anyone that might be able to offer him a plan.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will tackle some letters and we'll move on to other topics. We welcome you to write to us, panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. As promised, we are back, and we'll go to letters now. We welcome yours, panel@wamc.org. Alan, go ahead.
I will. Okay, here we go. So, we have heard from JM. Dr. Shartok said on the air this morning the reason for low Arab turnout in yesterday's election is that Arabs aren't allowed to vote. That is, at best, extremely misleading. Of course, Arab citizens of Israel. There you go, folks. Arab citizens of Israel have a right to vote. For whatever reason, those citizens voted in smaller numbers yesterday than in the previous election. Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank aren't Israeli citizens. My point exactly. Mm-hmm. So they don't vote in Israel. They are supposed to have their own elections, but these have been halted by Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. That's from J.M. Thank you, J.M. So there are a lot of Arabs living in Israel, in the occupied territory, who don't have the right to vote. It's that simple. VA says, enraged. I'm enraged that Trump continuously blames Democrats for the chaos at our southern border and that Democrats want drugs and criminals to come into our country. Where are the vigorous protests that should come from our Democratic leaders? Instead, we get weak, lily-livered denials that have little resonance. A pox on both parties, political parties, and that's from Virginia. And Keith says, Israel, if you annex land, prevent majorities from voting in elections that affect their lives, subject residents to poverty, and have families living in refugee camps to cover for over six decades, how can you really ever expect peace? Peace by force is rarely ever a permanent peace. If we replace the name Israel with any other nation's name, then the U.S. would have had sanctions on this country for decades. We must call out bad behavior on all sides, not just the Palestinian side. Dave said, if you work 20 years and earn $50,000 a year, you've earned $1 million. Most folks don't get close to that in 35 years. $1 million may not be what it used to be, but it's out of reach in one shot to nearly all of us. All congressmen go one way or another and come out rich. Government service enrich them all, which is why we are suspicious of them. And that's from Dave in Pittsfield. And Mac says, the rise of right-wing nationalist government, the rise of right-wing, rightward-leaning governments is being driven by a handful of self-interested corporate oligarchs and politicians who have deftly used the social media, cable news commentators, mainly Fox, to appeal to people's fears and base emotions to win over their votes in power. The letter's a little long, so I believe I'll stop there. Okay. Sonia says, greedy Bernie. Dr. Shartok, I am quoting your comment from Congressional Corner. Bernie Sanders has topped the millionaire mark from the sale of several books over the last few years. That is true. He's also donated some money from these book sales, which his returns will show. Well, when we see his returns, we'll know that. Please tell me this. Has he avoided paying taxes he owed? Has he hidden money in offshore accounts? Has he brought someone off to get his children into college? because I have no problem with millionaires who pay their fare fairly and play by the rules. And in this case, the man has been working so many hours fighting against rigged economy, a corrupt campaign finance system, a broken criminal justice system, and the climate crisis, his pay could very well break down to minimum wage in the end. He has promised to show 10 years of taxes and challenged Trump to do the same. I'm fine with Sanders being a millionaire. I am not fine with a president who has hired lawyers to avoid showing his. And that's from Sonia, who is, identifies herself as an activist, a humorist, and a humanist. And then we've heard from Neil Border. No, no, no. You're all talking as if the voters were reasonable and intelligent. Trump will deflect as always. I tried to control the border, but Democrats and liberal judges wouldn't let me. And a big chunk of voters will buy it. And that's from Neil.
All right.
Could be. And then we've heard from Rich, who said, border. Agree with panel. Trump is all about his image. The hard solution to the border issues is helping the countries to correct the problems for why people are leaving. Obama was trying, and that's Rich from Amherst. Did I ever tell you that Amherst is one of my favorite towns in the whole world? I think everybody there listens to WAMC. Russ says, follow the leader. Mr. Trump's problem with immigration is the existing law. Since the emergence of the Tea Party, there is no possibility of a change to the law, and the existing law does not support Mr. Trump's directives. As a result, the administration is continually working to avoid, undermine, or evade the existing law. Running an agency on that basis is impossible. And that's from Russ. Yeah, Russ. And Justin says, Sanders. Senator Sanders says he wrote a best-selling book, not just a book. So for anyone to say he made a mistake by saying you can be a millionaire too by just writing a book is disingenuous. If you are to quote someone, you should respectfully do it verbatim.
Sometimes humor and sarcasm don't translate, even though they should.
Well, I know what he said. You know, he said, I was watching.
No, but our comments here, we were saying, you know, if you want to make a million, you write a book. And I think we were just kidding.
No, but that's what he said.
Yeah.
He said in justifying, you know, him being a socialist, and he wanted to show equality of opportunity, he basically said you could write a book, too, and be a millionaire. Not so fast.
Thanks for the tip. I'm ready to go.
And Jill says, Trump wants a puppet. As I see it, I don't think Trump is looking for anyone with leadership skills or knowledge of the situations. I think he's looking for someone who will do what he wants them to do without question, someone who will say how high and when he says jump. Well, you know, Jill, I have an issue with this because I think a lot of them think that they're doing exactly what he said, and he still fires them.
And then you have Stephen Miller.
Yeah.
The lone survivor.
Okay, and then Dave says, I think it was John Kerry who said Israel could be a democracy or it could be a Jewish state, but it couldn't be both. I'll add to that, so long as Jews aren't the only people living in Israel. Should Netanyahu proceed with his half-baked notion for annexation, the question will be, what will become of the nearly 5 million Arabs in the West Bank of Gaza? Will they become Israeli citizens, bringing the current demographic of Arabs to Jews in Israel from 1 to 5 to nearly 1 to 1? And if so, what will become of Israel as a Jewish state? Or will they be denied citizenship as Israeli sanctioned subjects in an apartheid-like state? Some say they already are, putting an end to what some also say is a charade of democracy there. And that's from Dave.
All good questions.
Well, there you go. That's all I have.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue, and we'll move on to other topics. We'll go to news, and we'll have a break, and we'll be back. We welcome your comments. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we will return after this short break. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning, the 10th of April. Chris Churchill, Terry Gibson, Jen Smith, and Alan Chartok are all with us. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Hey, you have a letter, Alan.
I do. I want to read this one. Governor comments. Yesterday on the air, we'll all remember this, the governor said he wanted to fingerprint and do a background check of his daughter's boyfriend. And the reasoning behind it, which is so common to hear among authorities, was, quote, if you have nothing to hide, why do you care? This has been a rationale for many Big Brother invasions into our private lives. We're asked to trust them unconditionally. This is ludicrous, as history clearly demonstrates. Invasion of privacy, randomly to prove our goodness, in quotes, is the mark of a totalitarian society. Besides, it isn't a question of our innocence. It's a question of their, in capital letters, trustworthiness with the information they gather, which they have not proven. When someone like Trump takes office and sends his attack dogs out, who will protect our information? Now, I just want to say, I was on the other side of the microphone here when he made this claim about wanting to have his daughter's boyfriend fingerprinted and ID'd. And I was absolutely sure he was putting me on.
Yeah.
But he just pursued it and pursued it. It was very reminiscent of what Mario would have done to take some ludicrous concept and try to convince you, like the day he tried to convince me there was no such thing as the mafia, and ending up the next day in a Daily News headline, the wood across the whole paper said, "Yes, Mario, there is a mafia." So I said to him, "I can only imagine what my daughter Sarah, the PhD associate professor of political science, would have done if I said I want her wonderful beau." Fingerprinted and photographed. Amazing.
Again, people and their, of how much of humor.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with the letter writer. He may have been kidding, and hopefully he was kidding, but it is still a little bit of a scary line to hear any government official say, nothing to hide. What are they kidding? Well, that is an authoritarian concept. Uh-huh.
You're the governor. You have that stuff at your disposal. What the hell? It is your daughter.
Yeah.
That was the joke, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I
if it's a joke, it's, who cares? But
as you all know, Freud said, the ish no joke. there's always something behind every joke,
Yeah.
What kind of thing?
Okay. R. Jeremy says, why the increase? Does anyone know why the asylum seekers have increased so much? I offered a thesis here, I think either yesterday or the day before, which is that Trump is responsible for the increase by calling attention to this whole thing and say, no, you can't. And then when some judge comes around and says, no, you can't stop people from doing this, this is legal, they're allowed to apply for asylum. That just was an open green light for a lot of people to come.
There was also the theory that his constant threats to end the asylum process make people feel like they have to leave right away. Like this option may not be available in a year or two. Mm-hmm.
Think that when the president says radical things, it translates through sort of these individuals kind of have a communication chain where their friends and relatives here in this country are communicating with them. And so it's sort of like the game of, telephone or gossip, is that the president says something and then it's translated through family members and relatives and it finally gets to them. And then it's sheer panic. Like, no, you got to go now. You have to go now. So I do think Alan is right in that by his pointing a neon light at this issue every day, it has created a panic in some countries and people think they have to rush now.
Actually, that was Chris's point.
Thank
you, Alan.
And a darn good one.
Well, whoever made that point, I agree.
I did.
Don't you forget it.
It's only the idea that
we had a way to roll back the tape and listen to who said what. Yeah.
Let's do that.
You can all have credit for all I care. It's really insignificant.
But the economic conditions in those countries are also worsening. At least in two of the three, and so it's not just what Trump is doing, but it's complicated.
But it's a global issue too. I mean, there are so many other borders globally that are also experiencing spikes right now because of that element of fear, that now or never element, and the fact that governments are growing increasingly corrupt and also just people are being persecuted at a furious level, and a lot of these crimes aren't being whether it's kidnappings or beatings, they're not being addressed.
I think that one question I don't really have the answer to, and I don't know if anybody here does, but why are they applying for asylum instead of just sneaking across? Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just as easily, if you cross the border and you just wait to be apprehended because you want to apply for asylum, presumably you could have just kept going and gotten across without being detected.
Well, my intuitive answer is one is against the law and one isn't.
Right.
And most people don't want to break the law.
Right, and they don't want to live in the shadows once they're here.
Yeah, and they don't want to be separated from their kids, although that certainly is a possibility anyway.
They're less likely to be sent back if you go through the proper channels because under the law it protects them from being sent, you know, home versus like those who keep sneaking in, they will constantly be part of that cycle of deportation too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and back to the letters. Jade says, immigrants, mourning. What is it about immigrants, asylum seekers, that scares Americans? How does a person fleeing violence / death in their country and entering the U.S. in Texas affect a person living in New York? I can tell you how it affects my brother. He is a racist, and that is the only reason. No one's going to take his job. His economic security is not affected. He just doesn't like brown or black people. Please stop suggesting that people are entering our country illegally. It is legal to enter our country and request asylum, period, in capital letters, and join the conversation, Jade. And we just said that. We just said exactly that. Then it is legal, and the judges are saying so.
There is racism involved. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And people do need to differentiate between the illegal immigration that we've been hearing so much about for decades and what's happening now. But it also isn't true that people – I mean, my own mother thinks that she lost her job because of legal immigrants. And whether or
what
not
was
that's
her job?
True, she was in home health care.
And did she?
I don't know. But she feels that – immigrant workers in the Boston area entered the field, lowered the wages, and that she ultimately couldn't stay in that field. I don't know my mom is not a racist. I don't feel that she's a racist, but she has a legitimate economic complaint, and I think some of those complaints are legitimate. And for people just to wipe them aside as if they don't exist only kind of exacerbates the frustration that people feel.
Well, each case is different, right?
Each case is different.
Somebody
and every
says,
field is different.
I know my brother. I know he's a racist.
And I think there's
right. He probably is a racist.
We don't know. He's welcome.
Let's
to
get
write
him on
in.
And
he's
see.
Welcome to write in.
See if he is.
If you're the brother to Jay, you can write in.
But the economic argument. I mean, that Bernie Sanders has been making that argument until only recently that he stopped saying that. You know, high levels of immigration depress wages. I mean, there is a supply and demand argument that does have some validity to it.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you happen to be a farmer and your crops are not being picked, and the only way to get, you know, to sell your product is to pay people more in order to pick them, that's a classic example.
Right, and none of that justifies demonizing immigrants or treating them poorly. But I just do think that sometimes we do just shove aside any of the arguments that we don't like to hear and just call them racist because it's easy to do. I don't necessarily think that's
well,
fair.
And I think, though, there is this inequity of you know, we're focused, again, our national coverage is focused on one border and people coming from one area who look one way versus other borders where you have many more Asians coming into the country, people from Canada, you know, people who are lighter skinned. And there is that element of racism and inequity and coverage because someone looks more so different. You know, the numbers are definitely vary, but and again, you have to look at the ages of some of these people who are coming in are children. There's still a lot of children that are coming through.
And once again, I have to point out that the Trump administration is unbelievably inconsistent with this stuff because they have actually sought to raise the number of low-wage immigrants who are here on visas. So the rhetoric often doesn't match what the administration is doing behind them.
You think?
Yeah.
You know, when my grandfather, I'm told, who I did not know, came to this country from Europe, he carried seltzer bottles. Now, you all know what those seltzer bottles look like, right?
They're really heavy.
And when you carry a case of seltzer bottles up five floors in a tenement, that's a lot of carrying.
And he delivered them?
He delivered them.
People yeah. really wanted their that, seltzer.
That, that's what he did. He didn't understand that years later his grandsons would be grabbing those seltzer bottles and having seltzer bottle fights with them. But right. that's a whole other story. But the fact is that people will do what they have to do to get by when they come. And some of those are low-level jobs.
I was just going to point out, too, it's interesting that President Obama is out on the speaking circuit now talking about this very issue. And he, one of the things he's continuing to say is that he's warning Democrats to be very careful on this immigration issue, and that if you label everyone who has an issue with immigration a racist, then the Democrats are going to have a hard time building a coalition. So it's interesting to hear President Obama talking about this as well.
Well, that's very interesting.
Yeah, it's dangerous because we talked earlier about the kind of the rise of right-wing populism, and immigration and frustration over immigration is one of the reasons that that has happened. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of indisputable.
Joy writes, panel, Trump can't plan. He isn't smart enough to parse details to come up with a plan. He is accustomed to giving orders to his flunkies to come up with answers, and he gets to choose. And that's from Joy and Sprakers. Well, Joy, there's another way to look at that. He's the president of the United States, and there are many people who think that he has a very good chance of being president of the United States for a second term. So when you say he can't plan, it depends what you're talking about. If you're talking about planning for the good of the country, you'd be right. If you're talking about planning to get reelected, which is what I do believe he's all about, then I think you better think again.
Yeah, it's an important distinction to make. And again, he has proven to have the campaign planning skills he needed to get elected. And if that's what he's doing now, which by every evidence we see, he is just continuing to campaign and not really that interested in leading the country. So we'll see.
You know, it's interesting. I was listening to the polling this morning in the three states where he carried the election, and he's underwater, I believe, in each of them. And then the question is, are there some things you don't tell your pollster and you don't tell your mother? In other words, you know, if you're buying, yeah. if you're buying the racist you know, thing, nobody goes out there and beats their chest and say, I'm a racist. And in Israel, by the way, Netanyahu regularly underperforms in the polls by a lot. And yet somehow he gets a lot of votes. So that's one of the downsides of polling. Don't you think, Chris?
Not necessarily, no, because I think polling in 2016 was actually very, very accurate. So it didn't seem to capture any sort of hesitancy to say you're voting for Trump. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, the polls showed that Hillary would win by 2 to 3 points, and that's what she won by. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They just didn't know which states those people would be in.
Point well taken. Yeah. Joy says, Joy already said that. And now we go to Ben in Poughkeepsie.
Come around for the third time, Joy.
Emergency funding. The president has allocated emergency funding to the southern border against the will of Congress, and now there is a potential national emergency unfolding in the Midwest. If Trump's constituencies are underwater with inadequate responses from the federal government, won't he face consequences similar to what Bush had to deal with for Hurricane Katrina?
Yes, I think that's what I was saying earlier. I think the strongest argument Democrats can make is the incompetence argument, that he may like what he says, but he's not making any of these problems. He's not solving any of these problems. He's making them worse.
Maureen says, millionaire? One health care issue can take away people's savings in one swoop. That's right. Thus, another reason Republicans do not want health care for all. Voter suppression and economic suppression are their values. And that's from Maureen. And Maureen writes an interesting letter. I think this is one case where I wish it had been a little bit more full, so that the second sentence, thus another reason the Republicans do not want health care at all, because if they had health care for all, then people would. Shall I read the letter again? I'm reading the letter, and you guys tell me what I'm missing here. One health care issue can be take away people's savings in one swoop. Got it, right?
It became a puzzle at some point. Go ahead. Let's go. Let's figure this one out.
Thus, another reason Republicans—
I'm going to go to the bonus round.
Here comes the key sentence.
All right.
Thus, another reason Republicans do not want health care for all. Voter suppression and economic suppression are their values. Don't all talk at once.
I think it's been lost in translation, right? Okay.
Yeah. And Chip says, illegal immigration as an independent, I would like you to answer one question.
All right.
How many people should we let immigrate in, and that's in quotation marks, into the USA before Congress changes the laws to stop this influx? Ultimately, this will hurt our economy. How many crop pickers do we need? They, the illegals, seem to have more rights than I do. In fact, my tax dollars seem to be wasted on entitlement programs to help them. When we start talking about both sides of the story, your opinions are meaningless. Please report the facts.
Wow. Well,
what was the one question? Oh, well, I think the...
We're full, right? We can't. We're done. We're full.
Close it up.
That's the thing. We're full.
It feels full sometimes when I'm stuck in traffic, but that's. I think the point to make though is that illegal immigration is really not happening in a large scale. What's happening right now on the southern border is legal asylum seekers. It's a different thing. I think people continually confuse those two things.
Mm-hmm. Is there anybody?
There are a lot of illegal immigrants. There are a lot of people who are in the country illegally, but you know. What to do with those people is obviously a question.
They're two different issues.
They're two different issues.
Completely.
Yeah.
Mary says, wouldn't it make more sense to look at the crisis in the countries that these refugees are coming from? Why isn't there a plan to go to the source of the problem to alleviate the desperation of these families? Thank you for your program, and I look forward to it every day. Kind regards, and that's from Mary Ellen.
And we've talked about that. I mean, that's why it makes so little sense to cut the aid to those countries.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, well, there is a plan in place.
You guys are a bunch of liberals, and it makes a lot of sense, but it doesn't make sense if you're trying to put together the rationale for a right-wing political campaign.
You mean you think he's cutting the aid so that the numbers increase and then it scares people?
No, I don't mean that at all. Oh. Mm. No, I simply mean that he's got his issue, he's staying with his issue, and he's not an intellectual. And he's not saying, okay, we have to do this. We have to go, right, Joe?
No, I want to see if our special guest wants to come in and talk to us. We have a guest from Poland.
Yeah. We have a guest from Poland.
And I thought you're going to meet with him in a few minutes.
I am, and you're welcome to join
us. I didn't know if he would like to join us on the air and just say, be our Polish correspondent this morning. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hello.
I'm going to immediately put you on the spot and put you on the radio. Hi, I'm Joe. This is Chris. That's Terry. This is Jen. That's Alan Chartok, who you'll meet in a moment. It's riveting radio, isn't it? Tell us your name and why you're here.
My name is Rafał Kuś. I came from Poland to teach a whole semester at Utica College, and I'm interested in American public media, so I'd like to gather some research material as well.
Well, you're in for quite a learning curve here. What is the general gist of the thoughts of American media and what kind of job we're doing as it stands now?
Well, so far I have focused on the American public television, and now I would like to focus also on the NPR, on the public radio. And I think that American public media American public radio and American public television is an enterprise that is both so very American, as I think that it was constructed to reflect the American values and serve best the needs of the American nation, but at the same time, it's very un-American in the sense that it's so, unusual in this commercial media-dominated media landscape of the U.S. So I think that's a fascinating subject of scholarship, and, I'm so happy to be here in the United States and to be able to actually visit some NPR and PBS affiliates, and I'm hoping that I will be able to gather some material, gather some thoughts for my new research project.
Just remember, all public radio stations are not the same.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And
I'm fully aware of that.
I can tell you that.
I'm fully aware of that.
So is there the course you teach back home is...
Back home at the Jagiellonian University of Krakow, I have several courses which usually deal with some aspects of American culture or politics. I have a course on American media, American television, American rhetoric. I recently wrote a book about the political rhetoric of Richard Nixon. And
I bet you have a sequel coming.
That's extremely probable.
What is it? How do you teach, or a better way to say it, of how does do your students respond to what we're going through now in this country with President Trump and the way the media has responded to his presidency, not only here in this country but around the world?
Well, of course, our students are. Well, I work at the Institute of American Studies and Polish Diaspora at the Jagiellonian University in Krakow, and our students, we have some really bright students, very, very interested in all things American. So, every lecture is just a pleasure to conduct, as there is such a strong response from the students, and I wanted to say that they are really very interested what's going on in this new political landscape you have here for the last 3 years. And every 4 years we organize a special event, a special party when there is American presidential election, and
returns together.
Pardon?
And you all watch the returns.
Yes, of course. It all ends very late during the night because there is, of course, the time change.
Yeah.
But it's always an exciting event, both for the students and the faculty, which is, last elections results caught us by surprise.
Do you get American students ever?
Yes, of course.
Yes.
There is a special, we have also some American scholars working at our Institute of American Studies, and also we have a special program that's called the Transatlantic Studies Program, which is open, and it's intended for international students. So we got quite a lot of American students every year in Krakow,
great.
Poland.
That's great.
And it's
Raffle. That's right.
Anybody have any questions for Raffle? We have about 2 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Anybody? Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, I always have another question. And the question is this. Is there, tell us just a little bit in 2 minutes about the political status of Poland right now. We know that there was revolution, basically. What has happened? Where could you put it on a right-left spectrum?
I see. I would say that the political situation in Poland is a bit similar to what you have here in the United States, in that 4 years ago, in 2015, there was the presidential election and the parliamentary election, and in both cases, the elections were won by candidates of the now ruling center-right nationalist Law and Justice Party.
Yeah.
And there is quite a lot of political polarization in the society. There is really no middle ground. There are two extremes, supporters of the ruling party and also the opposition. This year we'll have the Euro elections in May, and
sure,
in the fall there will be a parliamentary election, which in our political system is the most important one. Next year we'll have the presidential election. So there is some possibility of a change in the near future. But of course, I would say that the election chances of both the ruling party and the opposition are.
So we've moved a long way from Lech Walesa.
Pardon?
We've moved a long way from Lech Walesa.
Well, Lech Walesa is still around, but more like a symbol of the transformation of what happened of our history. He's not that active in politics, day to day politics anymore.
But he wouldn't win, would he?
I don't think he would right now, because he's more on the one hand he's a legend, and there is no denying it. But on the other hand, there is he's also a politician. He is also a statesman who is very controversial in today's Poland's politics. For example, the ruling party are not great fans of Lech Wałęsa, so there is quite a lot of
tension
around Lech Wałęsa. But still, he's Lech Wałęsa, basically.
That accounts for something. Well, Rafael, he got off a bus, came over here, and then we threw him into a studio and put him on a microphone. I think he did an excellent job. Very nice to meet you.
Thank you so much. That was a pleasure.
Thank you very much. We'll converse with you in a moment. My thanks to the whole panel this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure. We will be back with more program after this short break.